Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about the proposed Homeless Bill of Rights for Duluth and the issue of homelessness in our community. Last month, Duluth became the first city in the state to support the creation of a Homeless Bill of Rights. Among other things, the proposed Bill of Rights would mean taking a hard look at housing issues in the community and making sure that low-income and homeless people have the same rights as anyone else in Duluth. But in order to put the idea of a Homeless Bill of Rights in context, we have to go back to what causes homelessness in the first place. Take a look at housing issues, mental illness, and chemical dependency. And finally, what a Bill of Rights might look like and how it would translate to action moving forward.
Good evening. I'm Rick Klun, and I'm the Executive Director at Center City Housing here in Duluth.
Good evening. My name is Bob Grittel, and I'm the Human Rights Officer for the City of Duluth.
My name is Lee Stewart. Good evening. I'm the executive director of CHUM.
If we back up from the idea of a Homeless Bill of Rights for just a moment and go back to the issue of what causes homelessness in the first place, can you give us kind of an overview?
Well, I'll start with that, and I appreciate the question, because in order to solve anything, one of the things we need to know is what is it actually that we're solving. The causes of homelessness are many. They have chiefly here with low income or no income or mental illness or chemical dependence or being released from a corrections institution without a place to go or a hospital without a place to go. But the sort of what is the size of the challenge in Duluth is something that I would like to share. Based on the statistics that of people who came to see CHUM, visit CHUM's shelters last year, we had about 1,055 people at CHUM shelter last year. Of those, 914 were adults and 141 were children. And of the 141, about 128 were less than 12. So there's a large number of homeless children. Families and children with children are the fastest growing segment of homeless people that we're seeing in Duluth.
And why is that?
A lack of affordable housing relative to their income. You all could chime to that too, but individuals have somewhat more options than families, but a lack of affordable housing is key to why people don't have a place to live.
I think a lot of the people that are homeless in the city of Duluth have challenges in their life. They may be behavioral challenges. They may be coming from abusive situations. They may have been unemployed for a long period of time. And sometimes it's difficult, even if there is housing available, for them to get the housing and maintain it.
And one of the interesting things, sometimes I hear, everybody is just kind of on the system, milking the system. In fact, 40% of the people who come to CHUM shelter are homeless for the first time or less than a year. And so they're in a crisis situation, and it's caught because of something like Rick has talked about, a loss of income, a use of income for something else, or some other crisis that has had them lose their home. So 40% of that, about 30% are what we consider long-term homeless, and 30% are people who, and long-term homeless has a definition to it. One of the things about homelessness is it has incredibly detailed definitions. Long-term is over a year or four times in the last 3 years. And think about if you're under 12, what that means, four times in homeless in the last 3 years. And then there's another third that have been homeless multiple times but don't quite meet that definition. And we work with anybody with a housing first approach to offer the sorts of services and support that will as rapidly as possible get them into housing that is stable for them and their circumstances.
If you ask most people, they would say, I'm kind, I'm compassionate, I'm giving. And this community really does seem to manifest that way, particularly
Absolutely.
As a community. But what is going on psychologically when you start talking about low income and poor people, and there's a little voice in your head that says these people are freeloaders, or they're milking the system, or they're taking advantage? What is it psychologically that prompts us to see vulnerable people as bad guys?
I'll try that a little bit. My experience as the human rights officer gives me opportunities to listen to a lot of people and listen to a lot of stories and have those kinds of conversations. And for me, the challenges is to try to get people to see that there are forces at work, systemic barriers, mental health issues, chemical dependency issues, that are beyond the individual's control. And the question you ask, what I heard, oftentimes in order for my own well-being, I want to blame the individual for the circumstances they're in. And that makes me feel more comfortable. Because rather than thinking that I may become afflicted and find myself homeless, I would rather blame the individual, that it's beyond, it's their control, it's their problem if they worked harder. So that makes me feel better, because really if I stop and think about it, and for me too, when I read the Wilder report of the hardest to most difficult to house in Duluth, they found that there is a lot of people that perhaps have undiagnosed brain injuries that influence their cognitive ability, just make it difficult for them to move through daily life in the simplest form. And so the kind of housing they need, they're going to need supportive housing. So when we're talking about housing, I think what a community needs, it needs a rich variation of housing in order to service the circumstances that the people find themselves in. Some people not only need affordable housing, but they need housing that has staff, it has supportive housing, it has someone there to help them manage their lives too.
And just to back that up, about 60% of the people who come to Chum Shelter have some form of disability. And so that special vulnerability is something that we need to pay attention to.
I'm not a psychologist, but I've been around a while. And back in the 70s, there was a national movement to close the mental health state hospitals across the nation. And the government chose to move people that were hospitalized because of mental illness back into the community without adequate supports. So while some people might call that freeloading, I think that's a breakdown in the system. And a large percentage of the people we work with at Center City Housing have ongoing chronic mental health issues, and those cause challenges for them to maintain their housing.
And I would say that both these comments relate to something which at Chum we would recognize as a really great spiritual challenge. If you read any of the scriptures, the idea of welcoming the other is something that we are called to do by those sacred teachings, and it's a challenge for all of us. So there's something about learning how to radically accept the other as somebody who is in our group and in among our community. And that's one of the messages that Chum always has, is that we are really trying to build one community that includes people with homes, people without homes, people with mental illness, people without, you know, that we are all one human family, and we need to approach our care for one another that way. And as far as the displacement, really, of people with mental illness, that is a spiritual failing of our country, and I consider it a communal crime that we've committed against people.
I'd like to add a little bit on to what Rick was saying about what occurred in the 70s, and about that same time, in the interest of full disclosure, I was a police officer in Duluth, and so I saw an increase in the number of people that were out and about in the street. The criminal justice system now has become the surrogate community mental health response. Large portion of the people that are in the county jails are people that have mental health issues, and the community's better response is in some kind of supportive, affordable housing. I talked to a man the other day who was born in Duluth, went through the public schools here. He is 40 years old, and in the 18 years that he's been an adult, he's been arrested for a variety of misdemeanor things and been to court 70 times. And so when you look at the cost and all those trips to the courthouse, and obviously the 30th didn't prevent the 31st, and look at the amount of time and energy and money and community resources that are expended on a criminal justice system response to someone. And he acknowledges he has mental health issues, he has chemical dependency issues, and he needs some kind of supportive, affordable supportive housing. Another part of his story for me was that at times he has been homeless, and at times he's been able to stay in a board and lodge. And in a Borden lodge, because he's disabled, they take his entire Social Security for support and leave him about $90 a month. And so when I look at that and think, well, what do you expect a 30-year-old single man with mental health and chemical dependency issues to do with his time and day with $90 a month, if not drink in the alley and panhandle and fight and do those disruptive misdemeanor things? We need to take a better look at that. We're already spending a huge amount of money and resources on them. I think if we spent the money in another place, affordable housing, supportive housing, that the community would be much better served, as that individual would be.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about poverty, homelessness, and the proposed Bill of Rights this evening. And our guests in the studio are Rick Clune, the Executive Director of Center City Housing, Bob Gritdahl, the City of Duluth's Human Rights Officer, and Lee Stewart, the Executive Director of CHUM.
I'm really interested. I'm learning a lot about these issues. There is a type of housing support which is called shelter plus care, which we have about 42 with that we work with HRA, the Duluth Housing Redevelopment Authority. And these vouchers are set up for people with disabilities to provide shelter plus care, with the idea being that if you can provide shelter plus appropriate care, they can live fairly stable lives. I got a report from the state about the care that went along with those vouchers, and it turned out to be about $10,000 per person per year to keep help with housing, food, medical, mental health, all kinds of diagnostics. And most of those people have lived very stable lives, and that's like 2 or 3 days in a hospital or 4 days in jail. You know, so I mean, it's just a much better system. We can have that kind of support for people.
One of the groups we haven't talked about is homeless youth, and I think we're doing a disservice if we don't mention those folks also.
I agree.
On any given night, there are hundreds of children in the city of Duluth that are homeless, and it's in large part not from their doing, but the life that they've been dealt, and they have huge needs. Lee talked a little bit about the Shelter Plus Care, and I'll back up. We've got 42 Shelter Plus Care beds in the city of Duluth, and that's great that we have those 42 and those people are being served well, but there's so much greater of need than the number 42. And I had one of my colleagues talk at a grand opening of one of his apartment buildings in the Twin Cities a while ago, and he said, you know, we're here today to celebrate 50 new units of housing. He said, but what about the other 5,500 people?
Right, and even in the housing bonding bill this year, it's talking about rehab, 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 but instead of, we cannot end homelessness with the housing stock that we have. There has to be a more rapid, affordable, and just a volume of building appropriate housing.
I lived in Fargo-Moorhead for a number of years, and I go back every year and I visit, and every time I'm there, it seems as though there's been another 3-mile expansion of condos, townhouses, apartment buildings. And in this community, all we're talking about is rehabbing this existing housing stock, and what is built is out of the range frequently of folks who have a regular median income.
You just gave me the perfect segue to put in a pitch for our housing summit that's going to happen on February 13th here in Duluth. And at that summit, we're going to look at what makes it challenging to be a developer, a banker, a realtor, and a person looking for a house in Duluth. I can address part of the reason that the expenses are high to build a house in Duluth, because we're challenged by that every day as a developer here in Duluth. And the terrain, the topography, the bedrock, all are atypical for building construction. And in Fargo, my guess is they are able to dig a basement without having to blast rock. We're in the middle of a building project right now in our Steve O'Neill apartment building. And again, this is not the typical winter, I think, in terms of cold, but we have lost so many days due to construction, in construction due to the cold weather, that slows down the whole building project, as well as I've heard the number 30% that people working outside in the winter in the trades are 30% less productive than they are in the summer.
And they'll tell you that, too. Here we have an artificially, I call it artificially tight housing market. Partly we are blessed with many University of Minnesota Duluth, College of St. Scholastica. Those universities and colleges don't provide housing for all of their students, as those students are renting units in Duluth. That takes up, and I don't know what the exact number is, I think something like 13,000 students are housed off campus. That creates a tightening in the housing market, which is what drives rent up. Students can rent a room at $400 a month and feel like that is a bargain, which makes a four-bedroom house all of a sudden be $1,600. And that driver, so again, the scarcity of available rental units is one of the reasons why our rental market is so high.
In terms of the lack of housing for homeless youth, we could build 150 units and we'd be able to fill them, not immediately, but over time.
And I think if we had, just to give you a shot, if we had 50 available SRO units, we would have almost no one in CHUM shelter right now. And if we think about, I would say 500 such units would make a very good step. We've had long recession, we've had employment crises, and people are moving around trying to find the best opportunity that they can find. Duluth is one of the stops along that road. If we don't start dealing with those fundamental issues of employment and housing where people are, that's going to be a challenge.
Back in 2007, we opened the San Marco, and I know we are the lightning rod for talk radio and other people who are very opposed to it. When we opened those doors, by moving 70 people from homelessness into housing, we saw a dramatic difference in the change of the downtown behavior of the community. People that were very critical immediately about whether it was going to work or not became very, very, very supportive.
That was the thing that I wanted to talk about next. In the past, the idea has been shape up, and then you can get a place to live. And now it's we'll meet you where you are, which may be in the grip of an untreated chemical dependency, an untreated mental illness, out of work. Explain that to folks, Rick, so that they've got an idea what that's about.
I think you just did a real good job of explaining it. Basically, what Housing First says is we're going to look at people where you're at, and we're going to help try to make you maintain your housing, help you maintain your housing. In a situation where you still are going to have some challenges in your life, and that includes a lot of chances, but it also includes some real basic concepts that you need to comply with. And that's, you know, you need to, if you can't get along with your neighbor, at least don't be harmful to your neighbor.
Yeah, avoid him or her.
Yeah. If you've got a chemical dependency problem, whether it's drugs or alcohol, do it in the privacy of your own room, but not causing problems in any public areas. We have done simple things and made a very conscious effort of putting individual bathrooms in individual apartments rather than the old style SROs where you'd have 30 men using one bathroom and 15 women using another bathroom, and two guys would go into the bathroom to take a shower or go to the bathroom, and one guy would come out with a broken, bloody nose. By giving people the dignity of having their own bathroom, we've eliminated all kinds of problems. And, you know, whether it's disorderly conduct or public urination or something like that, that's not happening downtown anymore because people have a bathroom to go in of their own. I'd say the same thing in terms of food. By giving people three decent meals a day, healthy, balanced meals a day, people's health are getting better. So they're not using the emergency rooms as often as they were. And their outlook on life is better. And they're probably not panhandling because they're getting three meals a day.
I just like to speak to the Housing First as from a shelter perspective. When people seek shelter at CHUM, we don't turn anyone away as long as they are not violent and they are sober. They must be. We have to maintain safe shelter for both our guests and our staff, so people can come in. But within 3 days, we expect them to meet with one of our housing advocates and make an individual housing plan. Part of that plan is that they have any income that they have, they need to tell us about that, and they need to set aside some with us, 75% if they're a family, 85% if they're an individual, so that they gradually, while they're in shelter, working on all of the challenges to get housing, they're saving money so that they'll have some money to put towards housing. one of the most common reasons people are asked to leave some shelter is they don't want to put housing first. We expect people to put housing first. So when you hear, well, Chum kicked me out, part of that is there's always a backstory about that. We rarely do that. But one of the things we do say is we're going to put housing first. You've got to put housing first.
Supportive housing gets people off the street, like you talked about, and it makes all kinds of other things possible. Help is available for untreated mental illness, for chronic substance abuse. It seems like win-win. So why the pushback?
I don't think there's a pushback. I just think there's a slow timeline for it. Would you agree, Rick?
I think there has been a pushback. I think while the AA 12-step model is very well supported and very well documented as working, it doesn't work for everybody. And the old paradigm was you had to be sober, you had to be in treatment, and then we'd look at giving you housing. And we're saying through Housing First and Harm Reduction, if you have an issue, we're going to put you in housing and we're going to help you maintain your housing. So if you choose to work on those other issues, you have the opportunity and the people there to help you.
So does this go back to this psychological thing, you don't deserve housing because you haven't shaped up?
In some cases, I think that's true. But in other cases, I think, again, the paradigm said you've got to complete X, Y, and Z before we're going to help you with housing.
And the reason I said there wasn't a pushback, I've just noticed that more and more of both the research and policy is promoting permanent supportive housing as a better solution than what we've had before.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the economics rather than the hearts and flowers stuff. And the economics is that supportive housing works. We've got a building down in Rochester, Minnesota for chronic inebriates. It's been in operation for 2 years, and the county administrator down there says very publicly that each of the people that's housed in that building save $10,000 a year for the county. So that's $400,000. There's another study that says for every $1 that's spent on getting youth out of homelessness, ultimately the taxpayers save $7. I think that was part of that Wilder study that Bob had mentioned earlier. And with families, it's much better than one-to-one at least.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about poverty, homelessness, and the proposed Bill of Rights this evening. And our guests in the studio are Rick Kloon, the Executive Director of Center City Housing, Bob Gritdahl, the City of Duluth's Human Rights Officer, and Lee Stewart, the Executive Director of CHUM.
We're just in the preliminary stages, and you know, a homeless Bill of Rights needs a lot of definition, and the community needs to define it. So in my view, it's the process of the community discussing and educating themselves on the Duluthians who are experiencing homelessness and having a conversation like we just had that is perhaps as important as the final product, that the getting a good information out to the public and having a strong aspirational statement that the public and the elected public officials in the city and the county and the school district can use as guidance when they're making their decisions. You can see the process to become homeless involves a lot of aspects of our community. And just like you were talking about the pushback, we need people to accept the responsibility and the belief that everyone who lives in Duluth has a right to have affordable, safe, and consistent housing, a place that they can call home, has food, and has those things that Rick was explaining in order to get their mental health in a place where they can start making wise decisions on their own behalf by stabilizing them and giving them things that they need.
Can you see, as you envision it, maybe looking forward, where some of those places are where the philosophy and the intent are going to meet reality? Where, okay, here's our, you know, we've said that this is what we want to accomplish in our community. Now we have the opportunity for an action step. Where might some of those places be?
I think they're going to be in the public forums, and I think they need to be talked about frequently and based on data. In my view, the question that I heard you ask, and it comes from my law enforcement background, you know, can we solve a social problem by passing a law and then trying to enforce it? And so in my view, that doesn't work. In my view, giving people good information and letting the attitudes in our community shift. And when I talk about attitudes in our community shift, in my lifetime, as I look around the room, in our lifetime, I've seen a huge shift in attitudes and in public acceptance of conduct. The first one is indoor smoking. All of us remember it wasn't that many years ago when people were smoking every place. Good public information and peer pressure has eliminated that. I can't remember the last time I saw anybody light up a cigarette anyplace. Also in my lifetime, roadside litter. When I was a young person, people were pitching stuff out of the cars all the time. And with good education and with a good understanding of why that is a bad deal, the social pressure, the social norm in our community shifted, so those things are no longer acceptable. The social norm needs to shift again, so when people drive down the street and they see somebody experiencing homelessness, instead of demonizing the individual, they need to say, well, wait a minute, how come there isn't that person hasn't connected with some service?
There is a whole bunch of very, very young, very good energy right now in the community of Duluth that's looking at helping ending homelessness. And I commend those folks, and I'm glad that they're doing internships at the universities where they're involved in social justice issues. They're coming out of college, and they aren't necessarily looking to go work in a Fortune 500 company, but they're giving a year or two if they are ultimately going to go into the business world. But they're giving a year or two to the social issues, and I'm just real encouraged by that.
A few years ago, I had an opportunity to be giving a tour of the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial before the Cozy Fire. And the mayor of a large city in Sweden was one of the groups. And he looks at me and he says, "You mean you really have people living in that building?" And what I heard him say is, "You mean here I'm coming to see America, the greatest country in the world, with all your riches and resources, and you have people living in a building like that?" I mean, he was too polite to ask it like that, but that's what I heard. And so the community needs to take pride. The people that are experiencing homelessness are somebody's son or daughter or brother or sister, their dad or mom. And when you talk to people, again, people aren't often forthcoming to say, "Yeah, I know my brother is homeless in another city. I haven't seen him for a few years." But there are a lot of those cities, a lot of those stories around, and we need to support one another and realize that the community standard has to rise and accept our responsibility.
One thing that I just want to comment on what Bob said is he said something about if you see someone that's homeless, that is experiencing homelessness, you can't tell lots of times. And that is one of the profiling circumstances that I think the Bill of Rights was partly designed to deal with. I was with someone who knew many people who were homeless, and I would have to say that 9 out of 10 times when she approached someone, I would not have been able to say, "That person is homeless, that person is not." So part of what we're looking at is poverty. Part of what we're and part of it you can't is invisible, and it's a very sensitive type of issue for people. And so one of the challenges is, thou shalt not judge.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Rick Kloon, the Executive Director of Center City Housing, Bob Gritdahl, the Duluth City Human Rights Officer, and Lee Stewart, the Executive Director of CHUM. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson with help from Chris Harwood and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.